Lincoln, New Mexico, January 8th, 1881. When Nathan reached the Silver Dollar, he got his first look at the female house dealer. She wore a green floor-length gown cut low and what might have been a diamond necklace, and her auburn hair came down to her shoulders. If she was surprised to see Nathan, she concealed it well.
Kate, you changed some.
Oh, I wear clothes when the occasion calls for it, and the name is Katrina McGuire.
I liked you better when you were Kate McDowell. You seemed a little more honest.
I'm more honest now than I've ever been. At least I'm trying to earn an honest living, but I suppose you're going to ruin that.
Not necessarily, but let's be honest with one another. I'm Nathan Stone. Now, who are you? Kate McDowell or Katrina McGuire?
Kate McDowell, but please don't call me that. I'm Katrina.
All right, Katrina, but I don't aim to forget you throwing my clothes and boots in the river.
You were a sight. Mad as hell and Jaybird naked. We'll get along, Nathan Stone. Play your cards right and you could see a lot of me.
You mean there's more?
Maybe a little. It'll be up to you to seek it out.
Lampasas, Texas, August 11th, 1880. A week after Sheriff Lyle Tidwell had been shot, Wes and Rebecca were able to talk to the lawman. He was still pale, weak, and almost apologetic.
I'm obliged, but I'm mighty surprised to find Patton hired you on as a deputy. Son, he ain't done you no favor. Soon as I'm on my feet, you'd be smart to just saddle up and ride on. Ike Blocker fancies himself the fastest gun around, and he'll be sure to test you.
Leaving you to face him alone?
I was elected to wear the badge. I got no choice.
In a way, neither do I. I've always had to fight just to stay alive, and I don't like men who bully others around. Maybe I just want to see if I have what it takes to be a lawman.
Well, I reckon you've come to the right place. I'd give a year's wages to see Ike Blocker get a dose of his own medicine.
How do I go about finding him?
He'll find you, once he knows you're here. He's insulted me just by ignoring me, stealing cattle and horses as it suited him. Then when I ride after him, there's a fight with me on the losing end. I've lost 2 deputies in 6 months. I believe he's left me alive just so he can taunt and humiliate me.
Suppose I take Blocker out of the running. Will that bust up the gang?
It'd go a long way.
Rebecca had kept her silence, but when they were alone, her reaction was about what Wes had expected.
I suppose you're going to nail printed Dodgers on every tree in the county, informing Ike Blocker you're waiting for him.
That's not a bad idea. You think it'd be better if I just wait for them to rustle somebody's cattle, ride after them, and take on the whole gang at one time?
It makes no difference what I think. Do it your way.
I aim to. I ride down every pig trail in this county. I want Ike Blocker to know I'll face up to him, that I think he's afraid to face me man to man.
I understand what you're trying to do, but suppose Ike Blocker has no pride. Suppose he refuses to accept your challenge and comes after you with his whole gang of outlaws.
According to you, I wrote the book on pride. I reckon I'm in a position to see that pride in other men, and I'm seeing it in Ike Blocker.
You've never even met the man.
I don't have to. I'm judging for what I've heard.
West Tremaine rode from one village to another, letting it be known he represented the law. Though Rebecca said nothing, she followed through on her threat to buy a gun. Wes had agreed, knowing how determined she was, and she bought a Colt Double Action 38. A little more than 2 weeks after he had been shot, Sheriff Lyle Tidwell was back on his feet.
You only agreed to stay until I was up and about, and I reckon I'm as well as I'll ever be. I'd like for you to stay on a while, but only if you're willing.
I can't go now. Blocker would think I made big talk and wasn't man enough to live up to it. He'll be along, and I wouldn't want to disappoint him.
Rebecca had begun to breathe easier, for it seemed like Blocker wasn't going to accept West Tremaine's challenge. But on Saturday night, September 3rd, what she dreaded most became a reality. Sheriff Tidwell stood in the door.
Blocker's in the saloon across the street, Wes.
Is he alone?
Yes, it's you and him. Some other gents and me will be back in your play.
I'm going with you.
No.
Yes, I'll stay out of the way.
They went outside. Wes paused on the sidewalk and a shadowy figure stepped out of the saloon across the street.
I've been hearing about you, bucko. You talk like an hombre that makes big tracks, but Ike Blocker thinks you're just a snot-nosed kid with a big mouth. You can take water and save your hide by skedaddling back into that hotel. You got to the count of five. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Ike Blocker drew. He had no chance for a second shot. Wes's bullet hit Blocker dead center, and he fell back through the batwing doors and died on the saloon floor.
Son, that was the nerviest thing I ever saw. You're a natural-born lawman if I ever seen one.
The saloon was in no hurry to remove Blocker's dead body, for it had drawn a landslide business. By the time the outlaw was carried out, the entire town had gathered. But Wes had taken the trembling Rebecca and had disappeared into the hotel. Sunday morning, Sheriff Tidwell joined Wes and Rebecca for breakfast at the cafe.
The sheriff's job is yours if you want it. You got more pure nerve than I ever had. I'll step down.
Thanks, but I don't want it. I'll stay a while in case some of Blocker's outfit has ideas of getting even.
I don't expect they will. It's the way of most outlaw gangs to have one really bad character while the rest lean on his reputation.
Oh, I hope you're right. I've been scared out of my wits, but now I believe Wes can defend himself in an honest fight. But it makes no difference how strong a man is if some coward shoots him in the back.
That's the God's truth, ma'am. That's the way Hickok got it, and I reckon it'll always be that way. But there'll always be a man who lives up to his destiny, even at the risk of having some two-legged varmint drilling from behind. I've heard it said a coward dies 1,000 times, but a brave man only once.
Somehow that makes me feel better. Wes can face those who will face him, and I'll watch for the cowards who would shoot him in the back. I have a gun.
That's the spirit, ma'am. A strong man needs him a strong woman, especially on the frontier.
Lincoln, New Mexico, January 15th, 1881. During his first week at the Silver Dollar, Nathan was pleasant to Kate McDowell, and nothing unusual happened until the following Saturday night. Slack Tarno came in just before midnight and, pointedly ignoring Nathan, took a chair at Kate's table. There he sat, a bottle of whiskey before him until a few minutes before closing. Finishing his whiskey, he got up and left the saloon. Before leaving, the dealers had to settle up with the house, and Kate finished first. When Nathan stepped out on the boardwalk, the town was completely deserted, with only an occasional light bleeding out into the street. The hotel was 3 blocks away, and Nathan could see Kate's shadowy form ahead of him. Suddenly, the girl disappeared. Nathan lit out down the street, cocking one of his Colts as he ran. In the pale moonlight, he could see boot tracks leading to the open space between 2 store buildings. He eased his head around the corner.
Let her go!
Why don't you come and get her, dog man?
Let her go and I'll spare your miserable life. Hurt her and I promise you, you're a dead man.
Maybe not. Now you pull your iron slow and easy and toss them out where I can see them. You don't, and I'll kill her.
While she couldn't free herself, she twisted around until she faced Tarno and drove her knee into his groin. For a few seconds, Kate was between them as she ran toward Nathan. Nathan ran around the corner.
How bad is it?
Bad enough. I'll be standing up for a while.
Come on. The whole town will be wondering about those shots. We can follow this alley the rest of the way to the hotel. If you're hurt badly enough, I'll get the doc for you. With any luck, nobody will find this varmint until sometime tomorrow.
Nathan got her inside the hotel and locked the door of the room before finding and lighting the lamp. Kate shucked her coat and skinned off her dress, then the little she wore beneath it.
Lie on your belly across the bed.
The slug had burned a nasty furrow along the inside of her thigh, and it bled so that it looked more serious than it probably was.
Is it bad enough for a doctor?
No. I have disinfectant and salve in my saddlebags, unless you'd prefer a doctor.
No. Go get your medicine.
Nathan went and got the supplies, then returned to her room.
I'll need to bathe that wound, and the water in this pitcher is mighty cold. Are you ready?
Yes. Let's be done with it.
Oh, God, that's cold. That's worse than being shot.
I'll dry the wound and spread on some sulfur salve. Then you can get under those blankets and get warm.
Nathan spread the salve on and Kate got under the blankets.
Nathan, thank you.
Well, no thanks necessary. That was Slack Tarno. He's had it in for me.
Damn, and I thought he wanted to have his way with me.
Maybe that too, but first he aimed to kill me.
Will you stay with me for a while, please?
Lincoln, New Mexico, April 27th, 1881. Since the episode with Tarno and Nathan's rescue of Kate, there had been no more animosity. Nathan spent most of his nights with Kate, but for empty's sake, he had kept his room. The dog didn't like Kate. Nathan understood, for he still believed there was something false about the girl, but he would face up to that when it became a problem. That problem came along soon enough, and it began with Cash Seaborn, the youngest of the Silver Dollar's four partners. One night after closing, Nathan took the opportunity to talk to Kate.
Cash Seaborn's spending a hell of a lot of time at your table.
So what? He's not sharing my bed?
Not yet, but he has ideas.
What man doesn't? Don't you suppose I'll have something to say about that?
I don't know. Depends on how strong you are about keeping your position as a house dealer.
I don't think he'd dare force himself on me, holding that over my head.
But Seaborn could, and did. Early Tuesday morning, an hour after closing, he came to Kate's door.
Hello, Katrina.
He wasted no time forcing his way inside, only to be greeted by Nathan's hard right.
Oh, you bastard! You'll pay for this, both of you!
I don't think so. You're trying to claim privileges that don't belong to you. You have three partners to answer to, and there's two of us to see that you do exactly that. Now get up and get out.
You ain't heard the last of this. I'll see both of you dead or locked up.
A few weeks passed, and Cash Seaborn all but killed Nathan and Kate with kindness, but he hadn't forgotten. Prior to his coming to Lincoln, he had worked with a small-time criminal in Santa Fe. Saul Yeager had been a master counterfeiter and had been caught and sent to prison for 2 years. Only by a quirk of fate had Seaborn escaped a similar sentence, and he had fled to Lincoln. Now he believed Saul Yeager had done his time, and Seaborn began devising a plan. If he could find Yeager, he could yet safely become a rich man while destroying the duo he hated the most. Reaching Santa Fe, Cash Seaborn began making the rounds of saloons and cheap rooming houses. When he finally found Yeager, he was holed up in a squalid little room and in no mood to talk to Seaborn.
Damn you! You let him send me up the river for 2 years, and you didn't lift a finger! You could have at least hired me a lawyer!
It wouldn't have done you any good. They got you with the goods. I got a foolproof system this time. You turn out the eagles like before, and I'll buy them from you half price. There'll be no risk for you, and you'll still earn half the profits, just like before.
Yeah, and when you get caught, you'll turn me in. No thanks.
Oh, don't be a damn fool. How can I turn you in when I'm circulating the phony pieces myself? I'm part owner of a saloon where I'll be passing the stuff, and if I'm caught, it'll be me doing the time.
I like the sound of that, having done 2 years while you went free. But I'm out of the business. They took my equipment and my materials, and I ain't even got the money to eat regular.
I'll pay for the necessary equipment and materials. Consider that an investment. What do you need?
For starters, a 10-mold die and a small charcoal stove. Bring me 2 ingots of copper, 2 of gold, and 1 of silver.
Damn, that'll cost a pile.
Your choice. You know of a cheaper way of getting your hands on $10,000 in gold eagles?
You got me there. I'll bring you the equipment and double all the metals. Turn me out as many eagles as you can, as quick as you can. I'll pay you cash. No strings attached.
Seaborn, you got yourself a deal.
Lampasas, Texas, December 24th, 1880. Wes and Rebecca were in Sheriff Tidwell's office.
We hate to see you folks go, Wes. Won't you stay with us until after Christmas?
Please, Wes, can't we?
I reckon.
The next several days were memorable ones for Wes and Rebecca. After a bountiful Christmas dinner in the hotel's dining room, an event attended by the entire town, Mayor Patton presented Wes with a silver-mounted Colt 4440. Upon it was engraved his name, the year, and the town's name. Into each side of the walnut butt was an inlaid ivory replica of a lawman's star. Wes said nothing for a moment as he stared at his boots. Finally, he swallowed hard and looked at the assembled crowd.
It's the finest thing anybody ever did for me. Thank you.
Removing his coat, Wes slipped it under his belt, placing the new weapon in his holster. Becca said nothing until they'd returned to their hotel room, and Wes wasn't prepared for her response.
I'm so proud of you.
Hey, now. I didn't get shot. Why all the tears?
Ugh. You still have a lot to learn about women. They cry when their hearts are broken, and when they're so happy, nothing else will do.
Tarnation. Somebody ought to write an instruction book.
Santa Fe, New Mexico, June 28th, 1881. When Cash Seaborn entered Saul Yeager's room, he eyed the four canvas bags on the table.
2,000 of them. Have a look.
Seaborn took one of the eagles and dropped it on the table. It looked, weighed, and even rang like government issue. Each of the coins had been poured from molten copper and then plated with a thin layer of an alloy of which 9 parts were gold and 1 part was silver copper. It was the exact ratio used by the U.S. Mint in the manufacture of bona fide gold eagles. Seaborn grinned with delight.
You owe me $10,000 in genuine gold coin.
I aim to pay you in full.
He flicked his wrist. Suddenly, Yeager's horrified eyes were fixed on the ugly snout of a double-barreled Derringer. Lincoln, New Mexico, July 20th, 1881. As rapidly as he could, Cash Seaborn began working the counterfeit eagles into the funds of the silver dollar. Every fourth night, he was in control until closing, and all the genuine gold coins reaching his hands were quickly exchanged for the counterfeit eagles. He had no doubt that the scheme would be discovered, but when it was, he was determined none of the evidence would be in his hands. As he paid Nathan and Kate their percentages, he gave them only the counterfeit eagles. Nathan became more and more suspicious, at a loss as to why Cash Seaborn hadn't made some move against them.
Perhaps he hasn't thought of a way without making a fool of himself.
Well, he's too damn sneaky and devious to suit me. I'm used to men who'll grab a gun and come looking for me, not some weasel that tries to get at me in a way that I can't get my hands on him.
We don't have to stay here. We could just move on.
We could, but it purely rubs me the wrong way to run out on some varmint that's out to get me. He always shows up at the wrong time, and I have to face him on his terms. That's how it was with Slack Tarno. Let's stick around a while until this rattler decides to strike.
It became a decision Nathan would regret. Just a week after Cash Seaborn had disposed of the last counterfeit eagles, Horton Goodner, president of the local bank, called on Jess Delaney, ranking partner in the silver dollar.
Mr. Delaney, we find ourselves in a delicate situation, and it involves the silver dollar.
Then speak up. What is it?
I'd prefer that you see for yourself.
Goodner produced a gold eagle. Part of the surface had been scraped away, revealing the copper underneath.
Why, that's copper. It's counterfeit.
Precisely. And we have more than $18,000 worth on our hands. The silver dollar is our largest depositor, and only your deposits can justify such an accumulation so quickly.
Have you spoken to Sheriff Garrett about this?
No.
Then don't. We'll stand good for the loss, if there is one. I want to talk to my house dealers and possibly question your tellers.
Very well. I'll allow you 1 week.
Lampasas, Texas, January 2nd, 1881. Before leaving, Wes had some questions about South Texas that Sheriff Tidwell tried to answer.
It's mostly cow country, unless you're interested in freighting. There is a mighty lot of goods coming in by sailing ship, with landings at Galveston, Port Lavaca, and Corpus Christi. Now that the Comanches has been took care of, it's likely the safest thing a man can do.
What about ranching?
Learning cow is just day in and day out hard work. Horses, now. It's a mite more interesting. Frank Bell's got a horse ranch on the Medina River, a few miles east of San Antone. His breakers are Lipan Apache Indians, and they gentle their horses without riding them down. Frank's horses are winning races all over Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Lord knows where else. As you'd expect, they're prime targets for rustlers. If you tell Frank I'm vouching for you, he might take you on to protect his stock.
That does sound interesting. I reckon we'll ride down there and talk to him.
Medina, Texas, January 5th, 1881. Wes and Rebecca, following Sheriff Tidwell's directions, reached the small town of Medina and entered the mercantile store. They found the store's merchandise limited. The owner was probably in his 50s, slightly bald, and over a boiled shirt and dark trousers, he wore a white apron.
Gib Watts, at your service.
I'm Wes Tremaine, and this is Rebecca. We're on our way to the Frank Bell Ranch. We're headed the right way, I reckon.
Indeed you are. Fact is, Mr. Bell's place is what give rise to the town. Without the business from him and the Lipans, wouldn't be no need for a store. We got more goods coming. Another month or so, and they won't have nothing in San Antonio you can't find here.
We'll take a couple tins of peaches for now. We'll likely see you again before long.
Do that!
The Frank Bell Ranch had a look of prosperity. Besides the ranch house, there proved to be numerous outbuildings. They were two long, low barns, each surrounded by six-pole-high corrals. There were horses in some of the corrals. The grounds were shaded by enormous oaks, and a line of cottonwoods bordered the Medina River. As they neared the house, a man stepped out on the porch. Wes and Rebecca reined up.
I'm Wes Tremaine, and this is Rebecca. We'd like to talk to Mr. Frank Bell.
You're looking at him. You and the missus stepped down.
He was tall, over 6 feet. And his high crown Stetson made him seem taller. He was dressed in dark trousers, a pale yellow shirt, and polished black riding boots. On his right hip was a thonged down colt.
Sheriff Tidwell at Land Passes thought you might have a place for me here.
I know, Tidwell. Why would he be sending you to me?
I like horses. Sheriff Tidwell thought maybe you could use a gent that's handy with a gun. That is, if you have rustlers interested in your horses.
Entirely too many rustlers. How handy are you with that pistol?
Handy enough.
Bill took a 2-bit piece from his pocket and flung it into the air.
Yep.
Wes plugged the coin.
Uh-huh. You'll do. See the house over yonder to the left of the horse barn? It'll be quarters for you and your missus. There's extra stalls in the barn for your horses. Come over to the house after you're settled and we'll talk. Supper's at 5 o'clock.
Lincoln, New Mexico, July 21st, 1881. Jess Delaney said nothing to his partners about the distressing visit from the bank's president, Horton Goodner. Instead, he waited until the following day, when it would be his turn to remain at the Silver Dollar until closing. Business was always slow until after supper, and when Nathan and Kate reached the saloon, Delaney herded them to a table. He didn't beat around the bush, but told them exactly what Horton Goodner had told him. He still had the counterfeit gold eagle from which the gold plate had been scraped away, and this he placed on the table. Nathan took an eagle from his pocket and with his knife started to scrape the surface. Seeing what he had in mind, Kate presented an eagle of her own. When Nathan had scraped away the thin gold plate from his coin, he took Kate's eagle and performed a similar operation.
Somebody's been working these counterfeit eagles into the saloon's take, and I reckon we're among the suspects, but there's something I want you to consider. Once every 4 days, Katrina and me have been paid our percentage in eagles. And I think I can promise you that every one of those coins is counterfeit. Do you reckon we'd be sitting on a pile of these phony coins if we'd been slipping them into the Silver Dollar's daily take?
No. That's why I wanted to talk to you and Katrina before going to the law. Or for that matter, even to my partners.
I don't aim to accuse anybody without proof. And if you'll go along with me, I can get that proof.
What do you want me to do?
Have the bank's president question his tellers as to the day or days of the week most of these eagles have been deposited. Then tally up the nights you, Kilgore, Guthrie, and Seaborn have closed. Get the idea?
Yes. You're looking to link one of us to specific days when most of these counterfeit eagles were taken to the bank.
I am. Can you think of a better way? It has to be one of you, me, or Katrina. I believe we've been here long enough to have proven ourselves.
I'll do as you suggest, because we must do something. But even if it all points to one of us, it'll still be only circumstantial evidence.
Well, just do as I've suggested, and if it works out as I believe it will, I'll get you the evidence you need. These counterfeit coins are so near perfect, I'd never have known unless some of the plating had worn off. That means somebody, somewhere, is a master craftsman. And such perfection suggests he's done this before. If he has a record, I believe we can find him and learn how these counterfeit eagles ended up here at the Silver Dollar.
You, or somebody, would have to telegraph every sheriff in the country to get information such as that. We only have a week before Goodner turns this over to the law.
Information on known counterfeiters should be on file with the Treasury in Washington.
Probably, but I doubt they'd release such information to us.
I can find out with one telegram. I'll send it in the morning.
Good. By then, I'll have written down our closing schedule for the past few weeks. Tomorrow, Goodner should have spoken to his tellers.
That ended the conversation. Delaney went about his business while Nathan and Kate took their places for the night's dealing. They didn't get a chance to discuss the situation until after closing.
It's Seaborn. He's framing us.
He's trying to, but we're going to beat him at his own game.
The next morning, Nathan and Kate met with Delaney in his office.
Here's a report from Horton Goodner at the bank. And here's what I came up with based on individual closings over the past couple of months.
It stacked up almost exactly as Nathan had expected. On days when large numbers of eagles had been deposited, Cash Seaborn had been in charge of the till until closing the night before.
Looks bad, doesn't it?
Well, it all depends on who you want to believe. You have every right to suspect Katrina or me, or both of us, unless there's evidence pointing to someone else. Whoever's responsible had to get the counterfeit coin somewhere, and I'm hoping the telegram I'm expecting will answer that question.
Nathan got his telegram later that day.
Master counterfeiter Saul Yeager, released from territorial prison April this year. Stop. Contact authorities in Santa Fe. Byron Silver.
Nathan and Delaney explained the purpose of their investigation to Sheriff Garrett, and he telegraphed the sheriff in Santa Fe. The answer, when it came, was shocking.
Saul Yeager murdered. Stop. Investigation incomplete. Stop. Suggest you come here. Now you've got my curiosity fired up. Delaney, let's you and me ride up there and see what's behind all this. Stone, you want to come with us?
Well, I'd like to, but I'll be needed at the Silver Dollar. We're trying to keep the lid on this until we learn more about it. This wouldn't be a good time for me to disappear for several reasons.
That's sound thinking. I promise you, we won't come back without some answers.
Medina, Texas, January 12, 1881.
Indian gentled horses sell for as much as $500.
Wes and Rebecca had spent a week at the ranch and were having supper with Belle and his wife, Martha.
I can appreciate that after watching Tameka and Wovoka work. They've been talking to the same horses for a week. How long does that go on before they're tame enough for a saddle?
As far as Tameka and Wovoka are concerned, that day never comes. The horses are never introduced to a saddle. They're expensive for saddle horses, and most of them are bought for the track. Unless a rider is mighty small, he can't afford the luxury of a saddle. Barnabas McQueen, a gent from New Orleans, bought two horses from me. He has a lady rider who rides them bareback, and they've never lost a race.
Where do these two horses go when they've been gentled?
You'll be meeting McQueen in Beaumont. As long as the buyer's in Texas, I think we'll deliver the horses. Several buyers had their horses stolen. It'll be up to you to get this pair to Beaumont.
I'm going too. I can lead one of them.
There may be some danger. Outlaws from Indian territory often drift into Arkansas and Louisiana, steal whatever they can get their hands on, and then hightail it back into the territory.
There's a track at Beaumont?
Yeah, and it draws horses and gamblers from everywhere.
And outlaws, I reckon?
Yeah. Sometimes there's as much as $500,000 in that town. It depends on the race and the horses in competition. I keep expecting a bunch of outlaws to ride in and take it all.
Bound for Beaumont, Texas, February 1st, 1881. Rebecca and Wes made camp near a spring.
This is exciting. After we deliver the horses, why don't we stay for the race on Saturday? I I've never been to a horse race before.
Neither have I. Since we're involved with Bell's horses, I reckon it'll be interesting to stay and see him run.
Perhaps we could win some money. I still have most of the money from the sale of the mules.
I need hot coffee.
I'll get some water.
But when Rebecca returned from the spring, she brought more than Wes expected. Behind her walked a trio of men, their weapons drawn. About to reach for his colt, Wes froze when he recognized the trio.
You always was a rotten shot with the Winchester, Moody. The varmint's alive, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
No matter. He's brung us a pair of prime horses. And after he's dead, we can put the gal to good use.
Knowing what was coming, Wes drew, but the odds were impossibly long. One slug struck Wes's head with the force of a sledgehammer, and then he felt an impact in his belly. The world went black, and he knew no more. Santa Fe, New Mexico, July 27th, 1881. When Delaney and Garrett reached Santa Fe, they went immediately to the office of Sheriff Hollings.
I'll tell you as much as we know and show you what we found in the room where Saul Yeager was murdered.
We're obliged.
Now, we know almost for a certainty that Yeager is the man who molded your coins, because he's been convicted at least twice for that very crime. I'm especially interested in your case, because Mr. Yeager had an accomplice, and we believe that's the man who murdered him. This hombre who circulates the counterfeit coins is a slippery coyote. There was never any evidence against him and nobody to testify. This time, however, we may have him cornered. The metals needed to mold those counterfeit eagles aren't cheap, and they can only be had through certain sources. We contacted those sources when our friend Yeager was released from prison. If he bought any of those metals anywhere in New Mexico, we were to be notified. Having gotten no word, we believed Yeager had at last decided to go straight, or had perhaps quit the territory. However, in the room where he was murdered, let me show you what we found.
Hollings opened a closet door and removed the items from a shelf. There was part of a bag of charcoal, a small charcoal stove, a 10-die mold, and parts of 3 bars of metal, one of which was gold.
My God, that's all it takes to create gold coins the equal of those coming from the U.S. Mint?
That and the skill to mix and mold the proper ratios. This may well be the key to capturing Yeager's accomplice, solving a murder, and nailing the culprit who is flooding your town with counterfeit coins.
We're in over our heads. We'll follow your lead.
And you brought the photograph of the man in question.
Actually, it's an etching. 4 of us bought a saloon, and there was a story in the newspaper. The paper created the etching to go with the story.
Here's what we believe happened, and the etching may get us proof. We believe that Yeager, just out of prison and broke, would have been reluctant to get back into counterfeiting so quickly unless somebody provided some strong motivation. It's pretty obvious from the amount of metals used and from the accumulation of counterfeit eagles you discovered that Yeager must have molded at least $20,000 worth.
Enough for a pretty damn good steak, or he wouldn't have shot the goose laying the golden eggs.
Exactly. We believe Yeager's accomplice bought the equipment and raw materials right here in Santa Fe. Armed with the etching you brought, we're going to knock on some doors and ask some questions.
The third stop they visited brought results. The proprietor studied the etching for a moment and immediately pointed to Cash Seaborn.
I know what's coming next, and it won't be pleasant.
I reckon it won't be. It'll be up to the courts of Lincoln and Lincoln County to prosecute. Much as I'd like to try the varmint here, he committed his crime outside my jurisdiction.
We won't waste any time nailing his hide to the barn door.
Before you do, we must try to recover the genuine gold coins he's replaced with counterfeit. The remaining 3 of us can't swallow such a loss.
It's unlikely that they're in a bank under his name. You can count on him having hidden them somewhere. Much as I hate to suggest it, you might have to plea bargain him a lighter sentence as a means of recovering the money.
Southeast Texas, February 1st, 1881. When Wes Tremaine regained consciousness, he was alone. The outlaws had been too anxious. One slug had creased his head, while a second one had struck the buckle of his gun belt. His belly felt like he'd been kicked by a mule. The outlaws had taken his horse, his woman, and the 2 expensive Indian gentled horses Frank Bell had trusted him to deliver. Thinking him dead, they hadn't bothered taking his gun. He shoved the weapon into his holster and set out walking. The trail led east, and he gloomily concluded they could be bound for Houston, Beaumont, or some distant point in Louisiana. But he had two powerful forces driving him. He knew the men he was trailing, and he wanted the three of them dead. Graveyard dead. Nathan and Kate reached the Silver Dollar at 20 minutes past 5. Delaney, Kilgore, and Guthrie were gathered in Delaney's office.
All of you gather around close. I have a lot to say, and I don't want outside ears hearing it. Please don't interrupt until I'm finished.
Delaney began with the bank's disclosure that the Silver Dollar's deposits had resulted in massive amounts of counterfeit eagles.
Damn it, why weren't we told?
You have been told, Hiram. Stomping around and raising hell would have resulted in allowing the culprit to take the money and run. As it is, we're going to confront him in a few minutes with enough proof to send him to territorial prison.
By God, you're saying Cash Seaborn robbed us?
Yes, and I'm telling you I have the proof. Now, Ward, sit down and shut up so I can fill you in on the rest of it.
Delaney spoke, and his partners mouthed curses, but they remained mostly silent. When he finished, his partners were livid.
Damn it, with all this proof you've got, why ain't the bastard in jail?
Because we don't know what he's done with our $20,000. We lose that and we're ruined. We're going to try and bargain with him. If he returns what he's taken and resigns, he goes free. Otherwise, we'll prosecute him to whatever extent the law allows.
You're forgetting something. There's been a crime committed, and you can't promise Seaborn the law won't prosecute. Is Sheriff Garrett aware of your plan?
No. All he knows is that we're going to try and negotiate for the return of our money.
Cash Seaborn entered the Silver Dollar, pausing just inside the door. Nearest him sat Nathan and Kate, while directly ahead of him, his three partners waited.
Come on in and sit down, Cash. We have something to discuss with you.
I'm comfortable where I am. Since when do you find it necessary to include the house dealers in our discussions?
This particular discussion involves them. You're responsible for that. The bank has informed us of peculiar circumstances surrounding our account. All evidence points to you, Cash, and there's more than enough to convict you. Return the money to us, resign, and you can walk away a free man.
I don't know what you're talking about. You've drummed this up to boot me out, to take what's mine.
Seaborn took a step forward as though to join his partners, but suddenly turned on Nathan and Kate, a pistol in his hand. The first slug ripped into the tabletop. The second slug struck the arm of a chair. The ricochet struck Kate McDowell in the head. Nathan rolled out of his chair and came up shooting.
Damn it, you've killed him! Now we'll never get our 20,000!
But Nathan didn't hear. Kate lay on the floor. Nathan knelt beside her, knowing she was dead. Sheriff Garrett burst through the door, a gun in his hand. He looked from Seaborn to Kate, holstered his gun, and removed his hat.
We tried to reason with him, Sheriff, but he pulled a gun and started shooting. He was shooting at Stone and hit the woman by mistake. Stone returned fire.
Damn it, Stone didn't have to kill him. Wounded, he could have talked.
It was a shameful, foolish thing to have said. And in an instant, Nathan had seized the front of Kilgore's shirt, standing him on his toes.
You greedy damn fool. All that matters to you is money. I wish to God it was you laying there with a hole in your skull instead of Kate.
That's enough, Stone.
After the coroner was called and the bodies were removed, Delaney hung back and spoke to Nathan.
This has been a most regrettable incident. Will you deal tonight?
No, not tonight or any other night. Tomorrow after the burying, I'll be riding on.
Southeast Texas, February 1st, 1881. Exhausted, weak from hunger, Wes looked down on the outlaw camp from the brush that grew along the rim. The outlaws were passing around a bottle. Wes was barely able to see Rebecca, for she had distanced herself from them. Somehow she must be made aware that he was alive. From one of the loops in his gun belt, he took a cartridge and, carefully judging the distance, threw it. It fell in the sand just inches from Rebecca. Using her body to hide her movements from the outlaws, she drew the .38 Colt from beneath her shirt, hoping Wes could see that she was armed. Even in the pale moonlight, Wes had seen the pistol and knew they hadn't disarmed her. There was no cover that would allow him to descend the arroyo's rim without being seen, and he circled around to the shallow end. He ground his teeth in frustration for lack of a means of communicating with Rebecca. Her accuracy with a gun, or lack of it, wouldn't matter if they made their move together. She would distract the outlaws, allowing him the edge he needed. Now he had but one choice, and that was to go in shooting. But all that changed in an instant.
Woman, get over here!
No. If you want me, then you'll have to come and get me.
Then I'll come and get you, and I'll take you first.
Come on, if you're man enough.
From his position, Wes couldn't see any of them. He waited, depending on his ears.
I have a gun and I'll shoot.
Sure you will. If you had a gun, you'd have used it by now. Oh, I'm shot!
Moody and Burris were on their feet, reaching for their guns. Wes gunned them down.
I saw them shoot you, but I knew you'd come for me if you were still alive.
My head hurts like nine kinds of hell, but I got here as soon as I could.
Oh, help me. I'm gut shot.
I'm sorry you didn't believe me when I said I had a gun.
Mister, I'm doing as well by you as you did by me. You'll lay there and take your chances with the coyotes and buzzards.
Beaumont, Texas, February 4th, 1881. Sheriff Waddy McLean stood up behind his desk as Wes and Rebecca entered.
I'm Wes Tremaine, and this is Rebecca. We're with Frank Bell, and we have some horses for Barnabas McQueen of New Orleans. Mr. Bell said you'd know if Mr. McQueen's here, and if he is, where we can find him.
I'm pleased to meet you. I'm Waddy McLean, and the way Bell uses me, I ought to be collecting wages. Yeah, McQueen's here. You'll find him at the Beaumont Hotel, I reckon. And if he ain't there, you put the horses up at Elkin's Livery near the track. McQueen's other horses are stabled there. If you miss McQueen, I'll tell him you're here. Where you be staying?
We'll stay at the Beaumont Hotel.
Leaving all the horses at the Elkin's Livery, Wes and Rebecca registered at the Beaumont Hotel and learned McQueen's room number from the desk clerk.
Mr. McQueen? I'm Wes Tremaine, and this is Rebecca. We're with Frank Bell, and we brought your horses. They're at Elkin's Livery.
Oh, much obliged. This is Bess. We were about to go to breakfast. Will you join us?
Yes, sir. We'd like that.
Hold on, and I'll get Vivian.
Wes and Rebecca said little during the meal, listening to the McQueens talk about their horses, races they had won, and races they hoped to win. In the course of the conversation, McQueen got around to praising Vivian for all her winning rides. Wes regarded her with new interest, while Rebecca scarcely regarded her at all.
I'm riding in races tomorrow and Sunday. Are you going to stay?
Yes, I'd like to see you. The horses run.
We'll race Modelo tomorrow and Patalo on Sunday. This will be the first time for Modelo to run here, and there'll be good odds. Be sure to place your bets.
Following breakfast, Wes and Rebecca went to their room.
You didn't ask me if I wanted to stay for the races.
3 days ago, you were the one who suggested going to the races. Besides, I wasn't aware that I had to ask your permission for anything.
I'm not going.
Then don't. You can sit here till moss grows on the north side of you for all I care.
Wes buckled on his gun belt and grabbed his hat.
Where are you going?
Out. I'm betting every dollar I have on Modelo.
That's a damn lie. You're betting on Vivian Stafford.
Have it your way. She's riding the horse.
Southwestern New Mexico, August 5th, 1881. Nathan rode as far south as he dared, careful not to cross the border into Mexico, but seeking a less mountainous terrain. Soon he came upon the ruts of what he suspected was the old Butterfield Overland Mail route. But there was something more.
Empty? These are fresh tracks. There's a wagon with four outriders up ahead of us. Who can they be, and where are they going?
It was an unlikely time and place for anyone on legitimate business, for New Mexico and Arizona were, although recognized by the Union, still territories. From El Paso to Yuma, there were hundreds of miles of Mexican border, a haven for thieves and killers who had ridden beyond the reach of the law.
By God, get your backs under that pole and heave!
Four Mexicans wearing leg irons threw their combined weight under a long pole, seeking to lift a wagon whose left rear wheel had shattered. Four men stood beside their saddled horses, Winchesters at the ready, while the man shouting orders stood with his hands on his hips.
Hassel, you and Thacker get ready to pile those stones under the axle when they lift the wagon.
Damn it, Childress. I didn't hire on to get down in the dirt with a bunch of Mexes.
Do as you're told, or by God, I'll have you shot for insubordination.
The Mexicans threw their weight behind the pole, raising the wagon, while Halsell and Thacker began laying the flat stones in place. But the stones had been hastily and poorly laid, and when the wagon was let down, the column tumbled. Nathan advanced. It was enough to get the attention of Childress, and he turned, his hand on the butt of his revolver.
Who are you?
Stone. Nathan Stone.
And your business?
My business is my business. Who are you?
I'm Colonel Barclay Childress, United States Army, retired.
Sorry, I can't say I'm pleased to meet you. Why are those four men in irons?
They're slaves. I bought them in Mexico, and they are mine to do with as I see fit. I'm taking them to Tucson, where they will be sold. Are you satisfied?
No. The days of slavery are over. You, or whoever has the key to those leg irons, set those men free. You're in violation of federal law.
Oh, federal law be damned. New Mexico and Arizona are territories. Now, who is going to enforce the federal law?
You, if need be.
How ironic. I believe this is referred to as a Mexican standoff. We must negotiate, I suppose.
No, you don't negotiate a man's freedom or his life. I'm ordering you one more time to set those men free.
If I refuse, are you going to shoot me?
If I must. I've shot better men.
Childress had moved his right hand closer to the butt of his pistol and believed he had an edge. That was his first mistake. He immediately made the second one, snatching the weapon from its holster.
God!
Now, who's going to unlock those leg irons?
Damn you! You broke my arm!
I could just as easily have killed you, but I'm saving that until I need it. Now, if you don't turn those four men loose, I'll break your other arm. Then if you still need some convincing, I'll gut shoot you.
Awkwardly, using his left hand, Childress loosed a leather thong from his belt. At the end of it was a single key.
Here, Hassel, unlock the leg irons.
Not yet. The four of you, toss your weapons over here. Then you'll unlock the leg irons.
Suddenly, the four removed their weapons from their holsters and pitched the guns at Nathan's feet.
Now, remove the irons.
One by one, the four Mexicans were freed. While they apparently didn't understand what was being said, they fully understood the Colt in Nathan's hand and the fact that the hated shackles were being removed.
Libre, Mexicanos.
Nathan pointed south. They understood that. Like frightened quail, they vanished into the underbrush. Nathan then gathered the reins of the four horses and backed away.
I'm not one to forget. We'll meet again.
You'll find your horses and weapons somewhere ahead. Replace the wagon wheel and you won't be afoot. I suggest you leave the mules hitched to the wagon. If anybody gets ambitious, I'll be watching my back trail and it'll be your last mule ride.